Celeb Savant is a career retrospective type interview focusing on singers, actors, and industry experts. Join Barrett Edelstein now as he dives into the entertainment world.
US-born and South African-raised vocalist and music producer Sito is best known for being the frontman for one of South Africa's longest existing rock bands, Vonderboom. Vonderboom celebrate their 29th anniversary this year and are still going strong. Recent highlights include being the sole opening act for Guns N' Roses in South Africa in 2018, performing in front of 65,000 at the iconic FNB Stadium. Side projects such as El Cantante, Absinthe and Bloodhoney have also kept Sito busy in studio and the live performance circuit. He runs his own audio studio where he composes, produces and does sound design for special and corporate events, TV and radio. Showcasing his vocal diversity, Sito has also had the pleasure of starring in a few high-profile musical theatre productions that includes Jesus Christ Superstar, Chess the Musical, Queen at the Ballet and Rock of Ages. Sito has also acted in front of the camera, which includes his 2014 movie Chanda Pahar and international TV series Black Sails and Strike Back. Cameo appearances include Getroud Met Rugby, Generations, Rhythm City and Binnenlanders. Creatively in studio, Sito is currently working on Bloodhoney, which sees release of their debut album in August 2025, as well as new Vonderboom material, and has embarked on a new sacred music journey exploring the potential of healing through music. Up next on Celeb Savant, live in studio at Solid Gold Podcast in Randburg, Johannesburg, South Africa, is Sito. With me as my guest, we've got Sito. Sito, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Let's rewind. At what age, whether as a child or teenager, did you feel cool? I want to be in this creative world, this music world, and how did that journey progress?
I would say it was in high school. I was really getting into secular music because up until the age of sort of 14, 15 or whatever, I was just brought up with gospel and classical. And, you know, you'd hear pop songs on the radio, but that wasn't really sort of endorsed at our home.
Okay.
Both of my parents are ministers and I was getting into Christian rock prior to that. And then I got into U2. Which were like my window drug band into rock and roll, secular music. And I had by then moved to South Africa. And then friends of mine at school.
Sorry, you were living?
I was living in New York prior to that.
Okay.
In Queens. And friends of mine at school had started a band and I wanted to join the band. And they kind of like said, well, what can you play? And I was like, I don't know. What's missing in the band? And they're like, well, we've got two guitars. We've got drums. We've got vocals. So I said, okay, well, let me take up bass. And then I took up the bass guitar as my first instrument. And so, yeah, about the age of 15 is when I decided this is what I want to do.
Did you know how to play bass guitar at that stage, or you just said, I'm going to do it, and you just learned?
Yeah. I didn't know how to play. My mom plays Spanish guitar, but like accompaniment for her singing. She's Puerto Rican. So I learned a lot from her style of finger-picking accompaniment. They call it second guitar in Spanish or in Puerto Rico anyway. And my father plays piano, but I hadn't taken on any instruments up until then. All of our family, like our siblings and all that, are naturally kind of musically gifted, singing-wise. And we were always singing in praise and worship at church and all of that. So I kind of had a natural ability to harmonize and sing and pitch, more importantly. When I decided to take up bass, I started to go to lessons. I first started on a keyboard, playing bass on keyboard, and a bit of a guitar vibe. Yeah, and then I got really into it.
Were there any aspects about learning bass that you found difficult or challenging or surprising, or you just said, I'm going to do this?
I think, you know, most people see the bass guitar as the tool of ignorance, and I think in many respects, it was a very easy instrument to learn to play because you're doing one note at a time. But the more I got into learning the bass, I realized that there's so much more to it. than just playing root notes or, you know, doing normal sort of scales, especially when you go into sort of jazz and Latin music and all of that. There's lots of sort of unexpected pockets that the bass would fill. So yeah, as I was learning to play, I realized that there's a lot more mystery and mystique to it, you know.
Why tool of ignorance? Why do people perceive it? I've never heard that before.
Well, especially in the sort of rock, you know, like rock garage band kind of approach, a lot of bands that get together. Because you're playing one string at a time, there's only four strings on it. Usually you're sticking to the root note and you have one job, and that's just to make sure you play that root note right, you know, and you're working with the drummer. So you're working with the kick more than anything else. And I suppose because you're playing one note at a time, as to a guitar where you're playing, you know, mostly six strings at a time, or you're playing lead with the bass guitar is tuned quite evenly spaced with the strings. And then in the guitar, after four strings, you go to the one fret less. It's usually the guy that's less sort of musically inclined that takes on the bass guitar, because usually musicians who take on a stringed instrument, like a guitar, they get heavy into the virtuosity of it, the technique, and like playing solos, and it's quite sort of flashy, where the bass is very unassuming in the background. And you know, you can spot a bass guitarist when he's playing on stage, you know.
How?
He looks like he's not doing anything.
Okay.
And that's not for all bassists. Yes. That's just, you know, especially the sort of rock scene, you know.
Okay. So was this a band that became Wunderboom?
No.
Okay.
No.
So let's.
Yeah. So that was I can't even remember the name of that band.
Okay.
But we only rehearsed. We didn't actually perform. Did we ever perform live? I don't think we ever performed live, like in front of an audience. We just like rehearsed at my friend's place. And that carried on for a while. And then because I got so into music, and I was in standard 8 at the time, grade 10, my academics took a bit of a knock and I failed standard 8. My dad was like, okay, fuck that. I'm moving you to another school, a school that's closer. Obviously, you're getting too involved with your friends and your academics are taking a bit of a knock. So I redid standard 8 at another school at Rampart High. And I was still heavily obsessed, and I had the advantage of doing standard 8. So my grades were actually good, but I was still obsessed with doing music. Mm. I met a few musicians along the way that became, you know, friends and colleagues, like Art Matthews from Just Ginger. Mm. He was in my class for a while.
Oh, okay.
At Ram Park. And so I carried on with that, you know. And then I made new friends and formed another sort of core band, but we did like very sort of random performances at the school. I organized a Valentine's concert with bands playing, and that was quite funny. But so then I left school sort of halfway through standard 9, and I went to technical college in Joburg at Doornfontein to study electronic engineering. And while I was doing that sort of course, I auditioned for a soul band, a 10-piece soul band. And I suppose by the age of 17, I was playing bass for a pro band. And we were like touring around Joburg, mostly R&B covers, like the old school Otis Redding, Aretha Franklin, Booker T and the MGs, you know, Wilson Pickett, Sam and Dave, all of that. And I learned a lot through that journey. And so, yeah, I was gigging it was called Heart and Soul. And we did that for a while. We did like Roxy's and the Black Orchid and like a lot of sort of cover kind of club, pub venues and all of that. And yeah, I learned a lot and I really enjoyed that.
And then what are the next steps?
So the next steps from that, I got frustrated with, you know, like not singing because I was just playing bass. And I rejoined with my friends from school and we formed a band called Moonchild, which was like a kind of a gothic rock band, alternative band. And then as we started gigging and getting out there, we shared a bill with a band called the Eight-Legged Groove Machine.
Mm-hmm.
And that had Martin and Wade, who I play with now. and we shared a bill, and we realized we played in a club called Tattoos in Rambouk, and we realized that we had a lot in common. And about 6 months later, they needed a vocalist and I needed a band. So I joined the Eight-Legged Groove Machine. And that was like in 94. And then, yeah, we did that. We started making waves, playing a lot at Wings Beat Bar. We did our first tour, you know, across the country down to Cape Town, Neisner and Rustlers, and like lots of wonderful experiences and stories. And then in the middle of 95, we were approached by the Electric Pedals. So that's Danny DeVette. And they just got the opening slot for Simple Minds, and they wanted to form like a super group. So we joined forces and call ourselves the Electric Pedal Groove Machine.
Okay.
Which is a super cuck name. but we did it, and we toured with Simple Minds. I think our third gig was opening for Simple Minds in Kings Park Stadium in Durban, 16,000 people. Mm. And we did Cape Town and Joburg. And we started on a high and quickly realized that there's no shortcuts to forming a great band. So we quickly dropped in sort of chemistry with each other, getting to know each other. Our songs are so different from Eight-Legged Groove Machine to Electric Pedals. Electric Pedals were like this very accomplished band, very mature and established sort of rock band, nominated for SAMAs, and I don't know if they actually won an award, but, and we were still sort of young and silly, and we had this sort of funky white boy thing about us. We were like the Chili Peppers meets the Levelers meets like indie music, you know? And it was quite out there. So the next sort of 6 months, we started touring, and we weren't sort of hitting the sort of fans that we thought we would have. And the January coming back from Cape Town, I saw a sign outside the N, outside Kroonstad along the N1 that said Wonderboom. And I read it as Wonderboom. And Martin, the guitarist, was like, no, it's Wonderboom. So we came back to Joburg, and we voted on names for the band because we needed a name, obviously. And there was lots of suggestions, lots of funny names. But Wonderboom was the one that won. And it was a good idea at the time, and we just stuck with it. That was in February of 96.
So you've been part of Wonderboom for a number of years. You also dally or into different bands, which we'll get to in a moment.
Yeah.
What keeps you and the band motivated to perform, create, and get out there and do your thing?
We just dig jamming together. We're like brothers more than anything else. We don't let the sort of lack of success put us off and make us give up on the band or music in general. We like love writing and recording songs together. We love hanging together, even just recreationally. And so I think that's what's kept us going for so long. And then obviously all of our wonderful experiences and our highs and our lows and our many stories that we've acquired along our 29-year journey.
The way you guys create music, how has that changed over the period of time, or is it still sort of the same way?
No, it has definitely changed, but the essence is still the same in that, you know, like Martin and I are the songwriters in the band, and sometimes I'll present a song or he'll present a song. And as we've sort of grown older, we, instead of presenting them to the band and workshopping them like that, we either work on them individually on our own, or we get seeds going, and then we sit together for hours a day, about, you know, 4 days a week when we're on a sort of creative flow, and we'll just spend hours workshopping and all that. Back in the day, it was just guitars and vocals sort of dry, you know, and now that we've sort of grown individually as producers, and we, you know, we've got our own home studios and all that, we do a lot of the sort of pre-production and get songs to a certain level and, you know, present them that way. And then we share files with each other and work in our own space. And it kind of changes over the years, but that's where we're at the moment. You know, we get it to sort of pre-production, how we hearing it in our heads, try to get it as close to that as possible. And then we share it with each other. And then sometimes we're surprised with what you know, the other brings, and then we present it to the band. And then the band also, that's another process altogether. We workshop it with the band. So with the drums and the bass. And if that doesn't work out, then we always have our original plans to work with, you know.
So the new routine of pre-production and doing stuff by yourself, has that made the process quicker or not necessarily?
Not necessarily. Like sometimes I feel that having all of that technology at our fingertips sometimes stifles you. You know, you have all these great ideas and then you start getting lost looking for the right sounds. And, where back in the day, it was just like, okay, here are the chords. Here's the, you know, sound. Like you don't really think about the production sound of a guitar or the vocal. You just think about the song itself, you know, the song value. In many ways, it kind of balances out in productivity. But when the inspiration's there and the guitar and the vocals and the lyrics all come to you at the same time, there's, you know, that's timeless. You know, that doesn't change.
Tell us about the other, I know you've got different other bands that you play. Tell us more about them.
So at one stage, in the sort of early 2000s, especially Martin was actually the first to have his first side project called Martin Rocker and the Sick Shop. And because we were, you know, in contract with ourselves and our management and then David Gresham Records at the time, there was a stupid clause in our agreement that we weren't allowed to play the same instruments in another band. So if you had another side project and you played guitar, you couldn't play guitar in that other band. You had to either do vocals or play drums or something else that wouldn't conflict with the band's, you know, the overall mission, you know? So he, to circumvent that, he got a wrestling mask, like a nice Mexican style wrestling mask, Nacho Libre style.
Yeah.
And he put it on to disguise himself and he called himself Martin Rocker. That's where Martin Rocker came from.
Okay.
And that's just stuck. That's his whole, you know, alias.
Okay.
You know? So you're not supposed to know that it's Martin Schofield from Vorne Boom. You know, and that was really doing well. He's recorded quite a few albums. I've produced a couple of those albums. Sometimes I play bass for his bassist when he can't make it.
Okay.
So, and then I have my own sort of alias as well called Rafael Sinvergüenza de Jesus. And yeah, so it's just like a fun project.
Yes.
And then after after we left Gresham and we kind of moved on, I formed a side project called Absinthe with the lead singer of Sugar Drive, Paul Flynn, where we do, all the sort of covers and bands, paying tribute to the bands and artists that have influenced us as artists. And we had lots of sort of common ground. So it's like it's a cover band basically with us two, but with an acoustic approach. So it's kind of like a Simon and Garfunkel with the way our voices work, blend together and what we play and all of that. And we've had different sort of iterations of that. Sometimes we'll add a percussionist or we'll add a violinist or, when we opened for Aha, when they came out, we had like a full on band with drums and bass and all of that. So that was quite fun, but it's all covers. And then after that, I would say my next sort of cover band is the Spanish project called El Cantante, which kind of pays tribute to my roots. And it's all acoustic and it's got Martin on guitar. So he plays lead and I play the second guitar and bass in the recordings and when we play live. And Rian van Rensburg on percussion, which is he's a wonderful asset for the band because he brings the proper rhythms to all the different songs. And that's also covers or mostly covers, and it's different styles, the Latin styles from mambo and rumba to salsa to cumbia to like kind of folklorica Spanish, Puerto Rican style. So like I try to keep it sort of in that sort of vein or those parameters. So we try not to get too contemporary sounding, like Despacito and all that, you know, like we try to stick to the roots so that you have a sort of definite kind of sound. And then a couple of years ago, I formed, initially it was a solo project, but then I didn't like the solo sort of banner. So I formed another band called Blood Honey, which is a very dark, very semi-electro gothic. I sing in a different range, mostly more baritone than I do with Warner Boom. Mm. And a big thing for me with the side projects was that they shouldn't sound the same. They all have their own distinct sound and feel, and you know, even down to image and everything else. Otherwise, you know, what's the point?
How did you choose the names for the various bands? Blood Honey, Absinthe, and El Cante?
El Cantante.
El Cantante. How were those names chosen?
So El Cantante means the singer.
Okay.
And when I was in a business partnership with a woman called Colette Dawson, who was really driving me to do the Spanish thing, in that process of coming up with the name and putting the act together, I had watched the movie featuring, what's his name? It's based on Hector Lavoe, Mark, Puerto Rican singer, J-Lo's husband.
Mark Anthony.
Mark Anthony, yes.
Yes.
So he starred in this movie, really cool movie called El Cantante. And I thought that's a cool name for the band. And so that's how I came across that name. Absinthe was Paul and I, we've got this really silly rapport when he comes around to visit. We'll sit around, drink coffee, like during the day, sit around, drink coffee, smoke spliff, and come up with the most crazy, like, what ifs, you know, stories and stuff like that. And as we were trying to come up with names for the band, we wanted to be as sort of pretentious as possible. And Cravat was one of the first ideas for the name. Call ourselves Cravat. Like, none of us are French, but we thought it would be like a cool, random name. And that fell away, and then we became Absinthe. But then we wanted to make it French, so we put like a back accent on the E, and we call ourselves Absinthe. But it's got nothing to do with French. Like, the French are like, what the fuck are you doing, you know? But yeah, that's just us having fun, very, very self-indulgence. At one stage, I wanted to change the name from Absinthe to Absinthe and change the S to TH. Mm-hmm. And so we were Absinthe for a day just because we thought it would be funny to hear people pronounce our name. And then our then Afrikaans manager was like, I just don't get it, you know, like, and then like later on, he like phoned me and say, okay, I kind of get it, but every time I say it, it sounds like Absinthe. And I was like, okay, that's not going to work. Let's just leave it at that. Absinthe is what it is. And so we stuck with that. And then Blood Honey. Yeah. I mean, it's so hard to come up with an original name these days. The music world is just saturated. And one of the things I realized, because initially I was releasing the songs under the name of Sito, I realized that, because I was doing it independently, sort of through DSP distributors, I realized when I go into iTunes that my songs would get lost under another artist called Sito. And it turns out that there's tons of Sitos out there, especially in the Latin world. Like hip hop and Spanish music and all of that. And I was like, okay, that's not going to work. Like it's a novelty here, but it's not a novelty there, you know? So then just trying to come up with the best name, and I would like do numerology and the words, you know, like all these different sort of variations and coming up with different names. And like, and the one day we were having a bee swarm or beehive problem at our home. They would keep coming into the electrical box and making like a hive there. And our neighbors are like, you know, we've got kids here. Can you please remove it? And my wife is a full on an animal and fauna and flora lover. And she was like against it, but we had to do it. So I got a beekeeper to come. And in the process, a few bees got killed. You know, they had to be, they were lost and they were, you know, and that really made her upset. And as a consolation, the bee keeper was like, listen, you've got all this honey. We had like a 5-liter tub of raw honey. He's like, this is yours, you know, do what you like with it. And I presented it to Linda, and she was like, I'm not having any of that blood honey, you know?
Ah.
So, okay. You know, the play on blood money and blood honey, and that kind of stuck. And I was like, cool. And then I looked online, and there's, of course, a few bands called Blood Honey. So I started fucking around with the spelling of it, which may be backfiring, but so it's BLVD, which just like people think it's Boulevard, but I'm using the Roman characters there, and then Honey, which is HVNNY. So
okay.
It's like a very unique, like I can't think of anybody else that would spell it that way.
Yeah.
So that's Blood Honey, and that's how we came up with that name.
And that's original music.
And that's original music. Okay. We do two covers at the moment. We do the Weeping Song, and I haven't released it yet, but we do Yazoo's Winter Kills.
Absinthe and the Spanish one?
El Cantante.
El Cantante.
Yes.
You said it's only covers. Have you ever thought of doing originals in those two iterations?
The question has come up lots of times. Because I've been away from the motherland for so long, I'm quite rusty in Spanish. So it's not like I'm speaking it all the time. Mm-hmm. So my first language is English. And when I sing in Spanish, I've got the phonetics right. I've got the execution right. And it sits beautifully in it, where I'm registered and all that. But to write a song in Spanish, I did it like maybe twice in my life, and it, very juvenile, you know. And for me to come up with new original music, I've got to really just maybe spend a good month and just workshopping it that way. The way my life is at the moment with my many projects and the different things that I do, I don't put enough time into the originality of that. So it's something that is on the cards and I would love to do. And I think that when the inspiration happens, I'll do it. And then when it comes to Absinthe, it's come up with Paul and people have asked us as well. But we kind of same. We don't spend enough time together writing, and we should, but we've got other things taking up our time, you know, and those things take time.
How do you choose what covers in either of those bands to perform?
Yeah.
Is it just what you love or any other aspects?
Well, most of the time it's like songs that I absolutely love, that we love. And then when it comes to like when we present songs to each other in Absinthe, Paul and I are very critical, like actually heads up our own asses kind of a thing. It's kind of like Empire Records, you know, like, oh, how can you not know this song? Or, you know, oh, really? That's like the worst, like Weeping Song that I did with, I actually did it as a collab with Ross from Sugar Prime Circle. Yeah. I actually approached Paul to do Weeping Song, and it was during the COVID era. So I felt really strongly about doing that song. Something about that song, it's not my favorite Nick Cave song, but it was something about that song that I felt was really poignant and like apt for the times, mm-hmm. you know, with lockdown and all the death that was happening around us. And like, you know, everybody was like quite miff, to be honest.
Yes.
So, and I was fucking around on a lap harp that a friend of mine had given me, and I worked out the melody of the main sort of motif. And I was like, wow, this is, hey, maybe I should do it. So I phoned Paul about it, and Paul's like, nah, it's not my favorite Nick Cave song. You know, you go ahead and do it. So I was like, okay, fuck you. So then I phoned Ross, and Ross came around and he laid down the most gorgeous vocals. And it's the best sort of received Blood Honey song. It was Song of the Year on Mix FM when it was happening a couple of years ago. And we did a really cool music video for it, like a one-shot video at Kitchener's in town. And that was lots of fun, you know. I like getting into character with some of these video projects with Blood Honey. Blood Honey has also become a big sort of outlet for my sort of visual kind of creativity. It's almost like the songs are cinematic kind of underscores for scenes in a movie, depending on the movie. That's the way I've approached them, and then the videos would then sort of capture that, you know. We did a song called Joaquin, which was co-written with a songwriter friend of mine who lives in LA, and we've been writing songs together for a few years, mostly for Blood Honey. Her name is Erin Alden, and she's really talented, and she's been really cool in helping me sort of develop and finish songs. I mean, I've got so many unfinished songs musically and lyrically and all of that. And so we've been working beautifully over Skype for many years, and now we're like moving on to WhatsApp and whatever. But so we had this concept of this song where the name popped out at me called Joaquin. I was like, such a weird name, such a weird pronunciation for it. And it just kept calling out to me, and all of a sudden the song sort of writing itself musically. And then she developed the lyrics with me, and we started researching like who's called Joaquin out there that we can base this song on. And it turns out that there was this sort of Mexican Robin Hood back in the day, back in the Gold Rush days, named Joaquin Murrieta, that the story of Zorro was based on.
Oh, okay.
And he was kind of like persecuted by these gold prospectors, these American gold prospectors. Mm-hmm. And he was like, his wife was raped and killed in front of him. And he managed to escape and he avenged his wife. And then he just carried on sort of robbing from all these prospectors. And he became quite a legend in that sort of California, Mexico, New Mexico area. Mm. And so, yeah, we did this beautiful song. And then I had a great idea. I've been working with some really cool directors, but one major director called Brad Devine. And he's already done like two videos with me. And we put all of our resources together and we made this like Western themed horse riding, the music video. It's quite epic. And yeah, I submitted it to film festivals and five different film festivals. We won the gold award.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So yeah, it's like its own kind of thing. I kind of feel like I'm writing songs for Blood Honey just to make music videos, you know.
What's coming up over the next period of time? Which avenue is things happening and which things are sort of on the back burner?
So yeah, this past year, we've been promoting the Vonderboom's latest album called Hard Mode. And we still have a couple of more singles that we're going to be releasing videos for and all of that. And that's been quite nice. It's released last year. And the Blood Honey debut album's coming out. So that's going to be out sort of end of winter, around August. And it's called IX or 9. And so I'm looking forward to that as well.
I love me a CD. I still budget for my CDs all the time, every month. Obviously, in South Africa, it's not really accessible for the overseas listeners. We don't have any sort of stores, franchises like HMV or Tower Records, like they are overseas. I love the journey of the choice, the unpacking, the booklet, the thank yous. For me, it's an energy exchange to you guys for all the hard work in your creativity. I'm sure if you're aware, there's a massive resurgence of physical overseas around the world. The year before last in the UK, there were 5.9 million vinyl sold, the biggest since 1990. Last year in the UK, there's a product of goods that they gauge exchanges on. There needs to be a certain amount of exchanges done each day for that product to be put in the basket for tax purposes. Mm-hmm. And because of the upsurge of CDs, CDs is now back in that basket.
Wow.
And cassettes are also on an upward. And the research is showing that it's the teenagers, the younger kids that are diving into the world, not necessarily the older nostalgic people. Mm-hmm. And then you mentioned the DSPs and those sort of avenues, the streaming platforms that people consume music on.
Yeah.
What are your observations of the landscape at the moment?
The Vonderboom album that we released last year, Hard Mode, there's no physical copy of that. And I think it's definitely as low as CD sales have been and as hard as it is to be selling vinyls, we did release a 25-year compilation called 25 a couple of years ago. And because it's gatefold and all of that, it's like quite expensive, but it doesn't sell quick enough to justify the heavy outlay for the label and for ourselves. But with the Blood Honey album, I'm going to do a pre-order campaign. The record company have agreed to match whatever is being pre-ordered, so at least we can get physical copies of that. The CD option is crazy because I'm also a CD guy. I've been chucking away lots of sort of superfluous and we've got doubles between me and my wife. We've got doubles of stuff. I haven't bought CDs in a while, and I love the CD vibe. I love going through the artwork. Mm. I love all of that. Yeah. All that stuff that you say, you're more invested in it. Like when you're putting on a CD, you're going to listen to the album. You're not just going to listen to a song and then forget about it and move on to the next thing. You know, the vinyl is even more sort of committed because it's like 15 minutes and you got to turn the sides and all of that kind of thing. I think there's definitely a desire for something tangible. Like even if you don't listen to this actual copy, you've got something to hold in your hands. Mm-hmm. And it's got to be, you know, at least like beautiful artwork. Like back in the day when CDs were in their high, I think, you know, a lot of bands and ourselves included kind of missed the boat there. Like we could have put more effort into the artwork and making it something that people would desire. But yeah, I think streaming, everybody knows it's just really just decimated the industry. Our merchandise in general, so t-shirts and caps and grinders and things like that. We've been giving our merch department some love over the past sort of 8 years or so, and it's really shown. People want something to take home. So I think we're going to do that with Wonder Boom as well with our last album, just to give something. I mean, CDs, there's not many places you can play it. My laptop and my desktop still have CD drives, which is something I'm not going to let go of.
Well, so I was living overseas. I came back just before lockdown. I have still got all my CDs, but I went to the avenue to play my CDs. And a lot of people said, there's no place to get CD players anymore, etc., etc. I went on to Takealot, and there were 50 to 100 options of CD players. And I had to narrow it down and narrow it down again.
Yeah.
And I got one. And the quality of sound is like enveloping compared to listening on a Bluetooth or a digital platform.
Yeah.
So there are avenues. Yes, they're not in cars anymore.
Yeah.
But they're definitely areas and places to get them.
Yeah, definitely. And if you just do an aux into your hi-fi or whatever you're playing your... But yeah, you're right. And like CD external drives and things like that, it's definitely doable. It's just there's people haven't been buying. So we did a CD run of our 25 compilation, and they bought more the vinyls than they bought the CDs.
Okay.
So
it would be interesting to see now. When was that? Like,
so that was like 4 years, 4 to 3 years ago.
Okay. Yeah. In fact, last year, HMV on Oxford Street, the five-story one, reopened. It had closed down and reopened because of the demand.
Yeah, I saw that as well. When we were in Dubai recently, I was like, wow. And of course, Europe and the States, they still have like, you know, even like old stock or whatever, they still have these shops that sell it. You know, people just dig tangible things, you know, retro and all of that. And it's great. And it's great that the kids are into it because they're the ones that have the passion and the drive, you know, finding old tape decks that their grandparents would have had and getting them going. And, you know, we've got a hi-fi component that's got tape deck and vinyl player and radio, like the tuner with the weighted knobs and all of that. It's the best. Like, it really is. There's a warmth to it.
Exactly.
There's like, it's a thing. You can have vinyl parties where everybody brings their favorite vinyl. You listen to that while you play games and and whatever, you know.
I've seen you a couple of times performing in different iterations. What do you enjoy about performing live?
I dig the exhilaration in the vulnerability and just, you know, something else happens beyond the rehearsal room or, you know, singing on your own when you're live on stage, like when you're exposed to the elements and you're feeding off the energy of the crowd and the band, and something else takes over that, you know, you realize you're just the sum of that. You're just one of the parts as compared to the collective of everything.
Yeah. You know?
And just seeing what it does to the crowd and in turn, how it makes me feel. There's been a handful of times where I've experienced the negative of that, where you just completely crash and, you know, die on stage for whatever reason. Luckily, there hasn't been too many of those, but there's something quite magic about performing live. Playing instruments, remembering lyrics, trying new songs. Like, I think it would be different if I wasn't doing new music in our sets. I think I would, you know, I would get bored because a lot of people expect the older songs, the classics or whatever, and we have to play them. But there's some that we leave out because we have to put new songs in.
Yeah.
So we rotate them and we try different set lists and all of that. So it's always kind of fresh for me. I always get nervous. I always get excited and nervous. And
the vulnerability, is that because it's in the moment, it's completely in that moment, and anything potentially could happen?
Yeah. From like technical to my vocal delivery to
rain.
Yeah. Attendance. Yeah. Like all sorts of things. Yeah.
Now, those situations where things went negative or they weren't great experiences, how do you pick yourself up from that situation?
It depends on what I'm doing.
Okay.
Like when I'm in my sort of comfort zone of being in Wonder Boom or something like that, I'm a little bit more relaxed and I bounce back easy and I can be honest and candid with the crowd. When you're doing something like theater, it's like you don't want to break that fourth wall you kind of just have to pick up where you or, you know, where you've dropped it kind of a thing and move on and pretend like it didn't happen, even though you're dying inside and everybody around you is also dying with you on stage.
Wait, what do you mean? Like sort of musical theater?
Yeah, like musical theater.
Oh, have
yeah.
you been in musical theater? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, okay.
Oh, I thought you knew.
No. So what shows have you been in?
I was in Jesus Christ Superstar, the 2006 production, and then we toured it to Greece and Korea in 2007. And then I was in Chess the Musical in 2008, locally as well. And then after that, we did a reprise of Jesus Christ Superstar in 2011 in the Teatro and Artscape. And yeah, I mean, that's like another world altogether. But yeah, like, so something like that, it's like, it's not like you can stop and like redo.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's like you just have to keep going.
Going, yeah.
You know?
So have you dived into the theater world recently, or have you just sort of diverted that thought?
The last production I did was Rock of Ages, yes. which was a short run. I think it was like 6 weeks or something like that. I think. My memory's really bad. And it's quite a commitment. And I can't perform with my other projects.
Yes.
And so that has like a knock-on effect with, you know, all the other band members and management and crew and things like that. Okay. So if I stop that to do theater, it's got to really be worthwhile profile-wise for there to be some kind of payoff. And then I'll like book time in studio and we'll record and try to use that time constructively. I kind of accepted that it's like either or. And also just being in all these different bands, like if I get sick or if something happens, then, you know, none of those projects can do anything. So it's quite tough being a vocalist where – like my guitarist, he had a skydiving accident a few years ago and he couldn't play. I think it was something like 3 months or something like
yeah.
that. And he, at the time, he was playing with Warner Boom, Martin Rocker, and the Six Shop, and he was playing with Flash Republic and he just couldn't perform. And so then we had to get depths in, you know, replacements to stand in session guys or whatever, just to cover the gigs or whatever. And it's okay when you're playing an instrument, but it's quite weird vocally, you know, to get somebody to stand in for you to do vocal. For some reason, people just don't like that, you know.
Sito, I love this game. I know if I had to ask you this question in 5 years, 2 hours, 20 minutes, I know your answer will be different every time. Okay. I recognize it and I understand that. Okay. I'm not saying favorite.
Okay.
I'm saying top of mind.
Okay.
On your way now, in your car, if you had to push play to five artists.
Okay.
Randomly, like I said, top of mind. Yeah. Who would those artists be? And if you can think of specific songs of those artists,
okay.
What would the songs be?
I'm enjoying the new Wet Leg song, and I've now forgotten what it's called.
Okay.
It's the latest song. Punch Me, Fist Something.
We'll get the audience to Google it.
Yes.
So that's homework
Please
for you.
Please do that. So that's quite cool. I love Radiohead, so anytime I could just press play. Everything in its right place. Massive Attack. Angel. I love all their music, but yeah, Angel would go down. Maybe some Aphex Twin. Very weird song names from the Ambient Works, my favorite album of his. So I can't give you a title there either. So
no, it's
please
okay.
Google that as well.
One more.
And then one more. Prodigy, Smack My Bitch Up.
Nice mix. I haven't heard of some of them, so I need to check them out.
Okay, cool.
Cool. So the podcast is listened to throughout the world. As a final message, what would you like to say?
Thank you for listening to my story. But if you could please visit any of our pages, Vornenboom, Blood Honey, Absinthe, El Cantante, and or even just personally, Sito, find me on Facebook, Instagram. I'm kind of moving away from Twitter. And I'm starting to get onto TikTok, but don't look for me now because I'm not there yet. But yeah, otherwise, it's been a pleasure and an honor sharing my story with you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Celeb Savant. Please follow Barrett on TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook @CelebSavant. That's CelebSavant.